It was the largest environmental bankruptcy in U.S. history. In December, the American smelting and refining company, ASARCO, agreed to pay nearly $2 billion to settle claims for hazardous waste pollution at more than 80 sites around the country. Cleanup will begin this year on one of ASARCO's most notorious properties, the copper smelter in El Paso, Texas. The aim is to remove toxins from the soil and groundwater, but as NPR's John Burnett reports, the legacy of bitterness in the community will be harder to erase.
Driving through El Paso on Interstate 10, you can't miss it. There on a bluff, a stone's throw from the Rio Grande, the old iron and copper smelter sits like a moldering Soviet factory. Time was the 120-year-old smelter, where metals are extracted from ore, was a pillar of El Paso's economy and one of the best jobs in town. Miguel Beltran, 82, is a former maintenance worker.
You can't get no job here in El Paso compared to ASARCO. ASARCO, the best place to work. We're just like a family.
ASARCO was part of the mining empire of the storied Guggenheim family that made the steel that helped the U.S. military win two world wars. But the world changed. Widespread opposition to ASARCO in El Paso and across the river in Juarez, Mexico, became a case study of a community's fight for environmental justice. Last year, the EPA turned down ASARCO's request for a new air emissions permit. Today, many people see the smelter as an environmental outlaw for contaminating central El Paso with dangerous metals and for secretly and illegally burning hazardous waste. Jim and Debbie Kelly stand on the slag field, looking up at an 800-foot smokestack emblazoned with ASARCO. They belong to an anti-smelter group called Get the Lead Out.
It was the largest smokestack in the country, and there were people in town who proudly proclaimed, "We live in a place with the largest smokestack."
They marketed it very well, and the people of El Paso were brainwashed to believe that this was the most wonderful thing El Paso could possibly have, was this tall, polluting, contaminating smokestack.
In December, Texas appointed a trustee to clean up the 400-acre site, which is contaminated with a periodic table of heavy metals: lead, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, selenium, and zinc. ASARCO is now a bankrupt subsidiary of the mining giant Grupo Mexico. The company paid $52 million to a custodial trust as part of its bankruptcy settlement. The plan now is to sell off the plant for scrap, isolate the contaminated soil, treat the poisoned groundwater, and finally cap the whole site with asphalt. A big question is what to do with the iconic brick smokestack. John Cook is mayor of El Paso.
You know, I would love to leave the smokestack there as a reminder, sort of a bookmark in history.
But whose history? The United States or Mexico's? Cook and other longtime El Pasoans remember when the wind would shift to the south, the smelter would crank up production, and the smokestack would gush dirty yellow smoke directly into Juarez.
They could basically pollute as much as they wanted because it was going into another country that had no ability to stop us.
As a result, sulfur dioxide and heavy metals fell on the colonias and schools and playgrounds of El Paso's sister city, where federal and state regulators had no jurisdiction. State Senator Elliot Shapley was one of those who led the fight to close down ASARCO.
It is very clear that a majority of what came out of that flue and was deposited over the 100 years landed in Mexico.
Colonia Ladrillera in Juarez is located less than half a mile from the smelter. People here complained of skin rashes, allergies, and asthma when ASARCO was operating. Longtime resident Consuelo Renteria is asked what she thinks when she sees the great chimney to the north with the barren Franklin Mountains in the distance.
Pues yo creo que representa coraje, diga. Porque dañó mucha gente, oiga.
I think it's a symbol of our rage, she says, because it hurt many people here. The people of the United States, they'll fix everything over there. And here, what will happen? Nothing. The corporate office of ASARCO in Tucson, Arizona, did not respond to an interview request. With the bankruptcy settlement, the company has a new CEO and has turned its attention to its remaining three copper mines in Arizona and a copper refinery in Amarillo, Texas. A statement on its website says, at ASARCO, environmental considerations are, quote, a way of life within the company. To this day, some former workers remain angry at the public thrashing the company endured. Pat Escondon and all the men in his family worked at ASARCO most of their adult lives.
Everybody was healthy. I even had my uncles were there. And they're all passed away in their late 80s. My dad was 87. I've never had a headache.
Despite his enduring company loyalty, Asarco's impact on public health in El Paso is irrefutable. A landmark 1972 study by the Centers for Disease Control found that more than half the children living within a mile of the smelter had levels of lead in their blood four times today's acceptable limit. A follow-up study determined that these outwardly healthy children had lower IQs and slower reflexes. The El Paso lead study was so influential that it contributed to the EPA's decision in 1973 to phase lead components out of gasoline. A similar study in Juarez found a mirror image of elevated blood lead levels in Mexican children. After these findings, Asarco discontinued its lead smelting operation in El Paso. To date, more than 1,000 properties surrounding the plant have been remediated or cleaned up. One of them was the home of Yvette Ramirez Ammerman, whose daughter Elisa was found to have lead in her blood.
She's 9 now, and she's had some issues. She's having trouble with math. She has some behavioral issues. It's hard to know whether or not that's as a result of the lead.
Ammerman, who now lives with her family in Albuquerque, is asked how she feels about Asarco today. Her response represents the anger and helplessness that's still palpable in El Paso.
Well, I can't say that on the radio. I would have their children be poisoned and have them feel it. No, I wouldn't do that. But there's a part of me that would like to say, in your greed, you allowed this to happen.
After more than a century of ore smelting and decades of conflict with regulators and the community, Asarco is about to become history. El Paso must decide what to do with the prime real estate after the remediation is completed. In Tacoma, Washington, and Omaha, Nebraska, toxic industrial sites belonging to Asarco were cleaned up and reused for condos, office buildings, and a convention center. In El Paso, once the poison has been buried, they can begin to look to the future. John Burnett, NPR News.
See a timeline of Asarco's history, which dates back to the 19th century, at our website, npr.org.
Sunday evening, it will be time to think in Roman numerals again. Super Bowl XLIV. It's in Miami. In fact, this year, Pro Football's All-Star Game, the Pro Bowl, was also in Miami last weekend. So for the XLIV edition, more than ever, Miami is a big tourist destination for pro football fans. And whether you go there to sample the football, the food, or the mass transit system, your most trusted guide to South Florida is, as always, columnist Dave Barry of the Miami Herald. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you, Robert.
The football fan who heads to Miami for the Super Bowl, what's the most important advice you can give him?
Be prepared. It's a little different from the United States of America, where many of them will be coming from. We have a sort of a different system of driving here. Everybody does driving according to the law, but it's of his or her individual country of origin.
I see.
You know, you don't necessarily know what a person means by a left turn signal. It could be a trick. Some people just put them on the night before just to make sure they're working.
But you do have mass transit apart from...
We do. It doesn't actually go anywhere anybody needs to go is the big problem with it. And also, we've had a problem with sharks on it. Well, one shark. No, this is true.
I remember. You've told it this before.
Oh, I did this. Yeah.
That's right. It's a good story. A good story is worth
telling. I want to stress nobody's ever been hurt by a shark on our mass transit system. Of course, nobody I know has ever ridden on it either. So, you know, it could be going on all the time, and I just don't know.
What stadium is the Super Bowl in this year?
Well, it's currently called Sun Life Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 weeks ago, I think, it was changed to that. It used to be Landshark Stadium, but before that it was Dolphin Stadium. Before that was Pro Player Stadium. Before that was Joe Robbie's. At one point, I think it's been named after a bar mitzvah boy. It's not a faithful stadium. Probably our biggest industry down here is reselling the naming rights to our stadium.
Now, if people arrive early, a couple of days before the Super Bowl, what should they do in Miami to kill time?
Well, in Miami, the heart of the action is what we call South Beach, where the main activity is trying to find a place to park. You go over there, and they have these clubs, a lot of clubs on South Beach. Usually there's celebrities in there. Pretty much one out of every three people on South Beach is some kind of celebrity, a Real Housewife of New Jersey, a reality show contestant. Mickey Rourke. You can't open a car door without hitting Mickey Rourke over there. There's a lot of celebrities. And they're in these clubs, and you can't get into the clubs because probably you're not attractive enough. I don't mean you personally, Robert.
No, that's right.
Just in general. But if you do get in, it's great because they play incredibly loud music and charge you a lot of money for drinks. And I don't know what could be more fun than that. But anyway, that's what goes on. If people go over and hang out on South Beach, and that's a big activity, if they can find a place to park.
And I suppose the last thing I'll ask you about is that when people arrive and then when they finally leave Miami after the Super Bowl, they could use the airport.
Miami International Airport and Permanent Construction Zone. Yeah, I advise people not to get too close to the airport. It's usually more convenient to fly in and out of someplace else like Montreal. You know, I'm going to get in big trouble now. I'm already in trouble with the Chamber of Commerce down here. You're just making it worse.
Well, I'm glad I could help.
I just want to stress I love Miami, really. If anybody from Miami is listening, please don't shoot me.
Well, Dave Barry, thanks a lot for talking
to us. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Columnist Dave Barry of the Miami Herald with advice to tourists to Miami for this weekend's Super Bowl. Welcome to Miami. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer in for Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Toyota has a new problem, this time with its prized Prius. Toyota said yesterday there were design problems with the anti-lock brake system for the Prius hybrid model that went on sale last year. The company said it has corrected the design for models sold since late January.
Meanwhile, Toyota dealers around the country are working to correct flaws with gas pedals that triggered a massive recall of other Toyota cars. These problems have focused attention on the government agency responsible for investigating auto safety complaints. It's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, known as NHTSA. NPR's Brian Naylor has reports.
The agency, which critics say has for too long been in the back seat in the Toyota investigation, was without a permanent leader for nearly 2 years, including the last months of the Bush administration and almost the entire first year of the Obama White House. Former Administrator Joan Claybrook says that lack of leadership left its mark on NHTSA.
I think that they're really on the ball right now. I think that they were behind the eight ball for a couple of years, and there were complaints that came in. They opened investigations. Toyota gave them answers, and they closed the investigations. And I think that as a result, some people have been killed and injured that wouldn't have been otherwise.
In December, David Strickland, a former Senate staffer whom Claybrook gives high marks, took the reins. NHTSA was a product of the 60s, formed after consumer advocate Ralph Nader's book Unsafe at Any Speed threw a harsh light on the lack of safety concerns in the auto industry. Claybrook presided over the agency during the Carter administration, a time, she says, when NHTSA's budget was in inflation-adjusted dollars higher than it is now. Most of NHTSA's money goes to states in the form of grants to combat drunken driving and promote seatbelt use. President Obama has proposed a slight increase for NHTSA, which would enable it to hire a handful more investigators. Claybrook says the agency has wide-ranging powers to probe safety-related claims that in recent years it's been unwilling to use.
While they have very strong authority for doing investigations, subpoena power, the ability to contract with companies to evaluate anything they want. They can go after the dealers or the suppliers or the manufacturers. They have tremendous authority. It hasn't always been exercised. That's the leadership issue.
In the case of Toyota, NHTSA was aware of complaints of sudden acceleration as far back as 2003 and opened several investigations. But they were always closed without a call for Toyota to act. Alan Kam was a NHTSA attorney for 25 years. Now retired, Kam says that within NHTSA's Office of Defects Investigation, or ODI, was a culture that was skeptical of complaints of sudden acceleration.
There tended to be sort of an institutional bias against sudden acceleration at ODI, this belief that going back some years ago that there's no such thing as sudden acceleration, it was just pedal misapplication.
In other words, blaming drivers for hitting the gas instead of the brakes. NHTSA has also been plagued with another Washington malady, the revolving door. Sometimes it worked in reverse. During the Bush administration, the agency hired a number of people from the auto industry to key positions where they looked favorably on their former employers. Claybrook says NHTSA has become too cozy with the industry.
I think it has been. A number of officials, starting in the Reagan years, left the agency and went to work for the industry, either as lawyers or as lobbyists or as engineers.
Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood has defended NHTSA's performance, telling a congressional panel yesterday that were it not for the agency, Toyota would not have recalled more than 5 million vehicles because of problems with sudden acceleration.
The reason they're where they're at today is because of our investigations, our meetings with them, the fact that then our acting NHTSA administrator went to Japan and met with the Toyota officials and told them in no uncertain terms, you need to get on this. You got a problem. You need to fix it. Find the fix.
NHTSA, which would not make Administrator Strickland available for an interview, is expected to use one of the strongest arrows in its quiver, a $16.4 million fine to sting the company. Still, that's far less than Toyota is likely to spend on the recall and lost sales of its cars. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. 70 years ago, Britain was at war with Nazi Germany. The policy of appeasing Adolf Hitler had failed, the old appeasers were out of power, and Winston Churchill was in. The U.S. was not in. President Franklin D. Roosevelt was aiding the British, but as for actually going to war, he faced a skeptical Congress. As London endured devastating German bombing raids, some Americans were there, assuring the Brits of American support and agitating for U.S. entry into World War II. Lynn Olson has written a book about three of those Americans. Citizens of London is about two men I've read a lot about. There was the fabled CBS reporter Edward R. Murrow, who told Americans what living through the Blitz was like.
Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away.
And there was the playboy industrialist turned diplomatic troubleshooter, Averill Harriman, who was in London to expedite U.S. military aid.
And it was an extraordinary experience. I don't believe ever in the history of a nation been so united, men, women, and children, and only one purpose, to stand together under the inspired leadership of Winston Churchill.
And then there is the forgotten member of Lynn Olson's trio.
The newly appointed American ambassador to Britain, Mr. John G. Wynant, arrives in England by air from Lisbon and is met by the Duke of Kent. Here are his first words on arrival.
I haven't much to say. I am very glad to be here. There's no place I'd rather be at this time than in England.
Lynn Olson, that was John Gilbert Wynant, Gil Wynant, arriving in England. And when he said there was no place he would rather be at that time, what was London like at that time?
London had been bombed for the previous 8 months. It had gone through the Blitz. Most Americans who had been there had already left. Gil Wynant came to replace Joseph Kennedy as ambassador and made very, very clear from the beginning he wanted to be there with the British.
Ambassador Kennedy, the father, of course, of President John F. Kennedy, he had not just left, he had left very flamboyantly and with no hope for the English.
Joseph Kennedy was not a favorite of the British people, to put it mildly. He was for appeasement. He went back to Washington to tell Roosevelt that he thought the British were going to be defeated and that America shouldn't help them.
So FDR replaces him with Gil Wynant. Who was Gil Wynant?
Gil Wynant was the former governor of New Hampshire. He was a liberal Republican. He supported social reform. In fact, he was a big advocate of FDR and the New Deal. He actually sacrificed his political career for Roosevelt and the New Deal.
He comes to a city that is being bombed, a capital of a country that has already withdrawn from the continent. And like Murrow, he wanders the streets at night during the Blitz. He talks to the Londoners as, in fact, they're under attack.
It was extraordinary. Yes, as soon as he arrived, he would go out on the streets of London while bombs were falling, and he would ask people that he ran into, that he encountered, what he could do to help, which was amazing to the British people. His warmth and his compassion and his determination to stand with them and share their dangers was the first tangible sign for a lot of the British that America and its people really cared about what happened to them. So he really became a symbol of the best side of America.
And indeed, he was an advocate within the Roosevelt administration for getting into the war.
Oh, very, very strongly. From the time he went over there, both he and Averell Harriman were badgering Roosevelt and other administration officials that England had to be saved and that America had to get in the war. Absolutely.
To say that these three Americans, Wynant, Morrow, and Harriman, were close to Churchill would be the understatement of all times. Harriman has an open affair,
right,
encouraged by Churchill, with Churchill's own daughter-in-law while his son is off fighting in the war. Later, when Harriman is sent to Moscow as the U.S. ambassador, she, Pamela Harriman, Pamela Churchill, takes up with Edward R. Murrow for a while. And Wynant, the ambassador, is having an affair with Sarah Churchill, the prime minister's married daughter.
London was extraordinary that way during the war. It was really a hothouse. You know, it's like covering a presidential campaign. I think being in a war situation can be a real aphrodisiac. It's everybody is thrown together, and things happen that normally don't happen. Churchill actually invested a lot in these three men. He courted them as relentlessly as he was going to court Roosevelt later on in the war. And so he drew them into his official family. He gave them tremendous access to himself and to other members of his government. But he also made them part of his own family. Wynant and Harriman, in particular, spent many, many weekends with the Churchills. And so, therefore, they really became close in every possible respect.
After the war, Edward R. Murrow goes on to run CBS News, take on Senator Joseph McCarthy, join the Kennedy administration. Averell Harriman becomes a cabinet secretary, governor of New York, very ill-starred presidential aspirant in the Democratic Party. Wynant has a very sad end after the war.
Wynant was Roosevelt's man. His whole life was bound up with Franklin Roosevelt. And when Roosevelt died in April 1945, it was really the end in many ways for John Gilbert Wynant. The Republicans no longer wanted him. He hoped that he was going to become Secretary General of the new UN, but that didn't happen when Roosevelt died. His affair with Sarah Churchill ended badly. He was an exhausted, sick man at the end of the war. And in fact, less than 2 years after the war, he killed himself.
In a way, his story proves the flip side of the aphrodisiac, as you say, and the adrenaline high that living in a war is. At the end of the war, there's no more adrenaline, there's no more energy, there's no more excitement in life for him.
Absolutely. And for quite a number of people, that was true. The war was the most exciting, the biggest thing that happened in the lives of many, many people. As horrible as it was, it meant everything to many, many people. And Gil Wynant was one of those. There was a sense of exhaustion on the part of virtually everybody who had played a significant role in the war, military or civilian. And when it was over, the after effect was very painful for a lot of people.
While reading your book, I took an informal poll of politically smart people I know who are of my generation, that is born shortly after the war, or maybe 10 years after the war, to ask if they'd heard of Wynant. And nobody had heard of him. I didn't know about Wynant. Maybe I'd seen his name here or there, but I had no sense of how important a character this was. He disappeared in history.
He really did. And that's a terrible thing, I think, because he was really a major architect of the Anglo-American alliance. He played a huge role in keeping it together, in kind of helping the British and Americans get along during the war. And to have him disappear so completely, I think it is really wrong. And I think it's important to restore him to the place in American history that he really deserves.
Lynn Olson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lynn Olson's book is called Citizens of London: The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. One solution to the nation's unemployment problem might be found overseas. President Obama wants to double exports in the next 5 years, saying that could add another 2 million jobs here. Analysts say it's possible, but only if the administration acts aggressively to promote trade, which could mean crossing and upsetting some Democrats. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Drew Greenblatt is an export believer. His company, Marlin Steel Wire Products in Baltimore, makes wire baskets for industrial customers like Boeing and Caterpillar. Thanks to a push in the last few years, exports now account for about 25% of Greenblatt's business. Or as he puts it, foreign customers put food on the table for 1 in 4 of his employees.
We have cars, homes, and mortgages being paid for because we're selling and competing vigorously against foreign companies. We are growing our company and hiring people to keep up with this foreign demand.
Greenblatt's 30-person firm has gotten help from the Commerce Department, which operates various programs to encourage exports. One of those offers a guarantee that foreign customers will pay their bills.
We shipped a job to Singapore that we never would have shipped, but the federal government guaranteed the credit, and we got paid and everything worked out. Because of that, Baltimore City employees were working overtime to accommodate this business in Singapore.
But Greenblatt's company is in the tiny minority. Less than 1 in 100 U.S. firms do any business overseas. President Obama wants to change that. Later today, Commerce Secretary Gary Locke will outline details of the administration's new National Export Initiative. Fred Bergston, who directs the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says boosting foreign sales is a good idea. But he says it will take more than government credit guarantees or stepped-up trade promotion to reach the president's goal of adding 2 million export jobs. Tackling China's currency, for example. Bergston says China keeps its exchange rate artificially low, making American goods more expensive and making it harder for American firms to compete in the vast Chinese market.
China has not responded to sweet reason, so it probably is time to toughen up the approach.
Bergston suggests the U.S. challenge China's currency valuation before the World Trade Organization. So far, the administration has declined to label China as a currency manipulator. Mr. Obama did say yesterday exchange rates are a challenge that should be addressed internationally. Bergston also wants the president to push for quick ratification of free trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. Mr. Obama stopped short of that in his State of the Union address, saying only that he wants to strengthen trade ties with those countries. When the president met last week with House Republicans, Illinois Congressman Peter Roskam told him the GOP wouldn't stand in his way.
That's no-cost job creation, but the obstacle is, frankly, the politics within the Democratic caucus. Mm-hmm.
The president acknowledged Democrats have been wary of free trade agreements, fearing foreign competition would cost U.S. jobs. But Republicans are nervous, too. Dartmouth economist Matthew Slaughter says voters in both parties have grown skeptical that free trade policies are working for them.
The average voter in the U.S. has been pretty on the fence about whether they want more trade coming into the United States. The income pressures that a lot of households have faced in recent years have sort of shifted that balance, where I think more voters now are a lot more wary of globalization than they used to be.
Mr. Obama promises to strictly enforce both new and existing trade agreements to make sure other countries play by the rules. But he told Senate Democrats yesterday America should not shy away from international competition.
We've got the best workers on earth. We've got the most innovative products on earth. And if we are able to compete on an even playing field, nobody can beat us.
Wire basket maker Drew Greenblatt says his company is living proof. Somewhere in Taiwan, he says, there's a shipping clerk opening a box of his products labeled Made in the USA. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Vancouver Winter Olympics are just over a week away. We're hearing a lot about skier Lindsey Vonn, snowboarder Shaun White, and a few other American athletes. But there are about 5,000 Olympians competing in Vancouver. NPR's Tom Goldman reports on athletes we're not hearing about now, but probably will soon.
His name is Peter Northug, and he is a Norwegian cross-country skier on a mission. Northug wasn't chosen for the 2006 Olympic team, a team that failed to win a cross-country gold medal. That's unacceptable in Norway. So 4 years later, Northug heads to Vancouver with Nordic vengeance on his mind. A patient kind of vengeance, says Norwegian sports broadcaster Paul Thomason.
In the lead group, he's never number one except on the last 300 meters.
Here goes Northug, putting the power on, sprint speed there. Look at that, massive attack.
That
massive
trademark end-of-race kick broadcast on Eurosport earned Northug one of his three gold medals at last year's World Championships. The man with the big finish has generated big hopes in Norway. Some say the 24-year-old could be the next Bjørn Dahle, the Norwegian cross-country legend who won more medals total than anyone in Winter Olympic history. And Northug has a big personality, too. No stoic Scandinavian here. Northug's been called a showman, a jokester, a trash talker by rivals, some of whom call him Storkkjeften fra Mosvik. Paul Thomason says it better.
Storkkjeften fra Mosvik. That means the big mouth from Mosvik.
Betty is a much more benign nickname, but it stirs passion in China, where Wang Bingyu, known as Betty, is a star of the women's curling team. China is hardly a hotbed for the sport of sliding stones, but the Chinese women grabbed a world championship in 2009 and now could challenge the traditional powers like Sweden and host country Canada. Maggie Rauch edits the website China Sports Today. She says China has taken to its women curling champions. They're part of a post-Tiananmen Square generation often criticized for being spoiled and rebellious, but Rauch says Betty and the gang are portrayed differently.
I think they've been sort of held up as an example of four girls that are part of this generation that are enjoying life in the new China and are doing it in a very approachable, joyful sort of way.
For instance, Betty likes to sing. She was asked to do so in a televised interview, and she complied with a happy love song called Nuan Nuan, or Warm Warm. Of course, what would a gathering of nations be without tension? And Russian figure skaters Oksana Domnina and Maxim Shabalin have provided that with their controversial Olympic ice dancing program. Dressed in brown bodysuits wearing leaves and face paint, they intended it as a dance of Australian Aboriginals. Didn't work. Lots of criticism. Stephen Page, artistic director for the Australian Bangara Dance Theatre, thought the routine was disrespectful.
Well, you just have to have a look at how they looked. I believe now that we just tend to just bastardize any form of culture.
The skaters defend their program and plan to perform it at the Olympics, an Olympics that's notable for being the first to have a formal partnership between the host country organizers and indigenous groups. Tom Goldman, NPR News.